A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those prompts that sounds simple, but immediately makes you realize you've just been nodding along to vague assumptions. How many scientists are actually stationed at the North Pole and in Antarctica at any given time? Do scientists at different research stations ever visit each other, or are the distances just too brutal? And the one everyone secretly wonders about, is there alcohol at the bottom of the world, and how much? The answers turn out to be smaller, stranger, and more revealing than I expected.
The North Pole has zero permanent scientists. Not a handful, not a small rotating crew. There is no land at the North Pole. It's drifting sea ice. You can't build a station on it the way you can in Antarctica. The closest thing to a research presence at the North Pole is the Russian Drifting Ice Station program. Station NP-41 was deployed in September 2025, and it hosts about 15 to 20 people total, most of whom are support and logistics staff, not research scientists. And that station drifts. It moves with the ice. It's not at the North Pole in any fixed way.
When someone says scientists at the North Pole, what they're probably picturing is a permanent base with a flag and some guy in a parka taking measurements. The reality is a handful of Russians on a floating slab of ice that's slowly disintegrating.
Well, not exactly, but that's the picture. The drifting station model is fascinating but precarious. Ice stations typically last 1 to 3 years before the flow breaks up and they have to evacuate. The Soviet Union ran these continuously from 1937, but after a hiatus in the 2010s, Russia restarted the program. NP-41 is the current one. And the personnel count is tiny. Maybe 3 or 4 of those 15 to 20 people are doing publishable science. The rest are keeping the generators running and the polar bears at a distance.
3 or 4 scientists on the entire Arctic Ocean. That's a smaller research team than the average university geology department field trip.
It gets at a fundamental geographic distinction that most people blur. The Arctic is an ocean surrounded by continents. The Antarctic is a continent surrounded by oceans. The North Pole is water under ice. The South Pole is land under ice, specifically the Amundsen. Scott's South Pole station sits on an ice sheet 2,835 meters thick. That's nearly 3 kilometers of ice between the station floor and actual bedrock. And the whole thing is drifting. The ice sheet, I mean, about 10 meters per year toward the Weddell Sea.
Even the South Pole station isn't actually at the South Pole for very long. The ice it's built on is slowly migrating out from under it, and they have to reposition the marker each year.
The ceremonial pole gets moved annually. The geographic pole, the actual 90 degrees south, is marked by a simple metal rod that gets driven into the ice at the correct coordinates each January. By the following January, it's 10 meters off.
Of course it is. Nothing about the poles wants to stay put. So let's get into the numbers, because the prompt's first question is deceptively straightforward. How many scientists are actually there?
Let's start with Antarctica, because that's where the real population is. The continent hosts about 40 year-round research stations operated by roughly 30 countries, plus another 30 or so seasonal field camps that only operate in summer. Summer runs from October through February. During the 2025 to 2026 summer season, the total Antarctic population peaked at around 5,000 people across all stations.
That's a small town. I was picturing something more like a university campus.
It's smaller than most university campuses. And here's the key breakdown. At McMurdo Station, the largest base, it's American, on Ross Island, the summer population was 1,047 personnel this past season. Of those, 312 were directly funded research scientists. The other 735 were support, electricians, plumbers, cooks, helicopter pilots, cargo specialists, IT staff, medical personnel.
Barely 30% are scientists. The rest are keeping the scientists alive and functional.
That's the ratio, and it's consistent across most stations. Antarctic science is a massive hospitality and logistics operation that happens to produce research papers. The U.S. Antarctic Program employs about 3,000 people total during the summer season, including those at McMurdo, the South Pole Station, and the field camps. The actual number of scientists among them is around 850. That's where the numbers get stark. From March through September, most stations drastically reduce crew. The total Antarctic winter population is about 1,000 people across the entire continent. McMurdo drops from 1,000 to about 150. The South Pole Station drops to 42 people this winter. That's the 2026 winter over crew. Concordia Station, the French-Italian base, up on the polar plateau at 3,233 meters elevation, runs with 13 people in winter.
13 people, at an altitude where the air has half the oxygen of sea level, in total darkness for months. That's not a research station. That's a psychological experiment that happens to collect climate data.
Concordia is actually used as a psychological analog for space missions. The European Space Agency studies winter over crews there because the isolation and sensory deprivation are comparable to what astronauts would experience on a Mars mission. But yes, across the entire Antarctic continent in July, you have fewer than 1,000 humans, and only a subset of those are active scientists. Maybe 400 to 500 researchers total during the winter months.
The answer to the first question is, Antarctica in summer, maybe 850 scientists. Antarctica in winter, maybe 400. North Pole, effectively zero. Three or four if you count the drifting ice station crew. These are absurdly small numbers for a continent and an ocean.
The winter over-selection process reveals why the numbers are so constrained. You don't just volunteer. Candidates go through psychological screening that includes structured interviews, stress tests, and what's essentially a psychiatric evaluation focused on resilience to isolation. They're cross-trained in mandatory skills, basic medical response, firefighting, equipment repair, because if something breaks in July, there is no outside help. The last flight leaves in February and the next one arrives in October. That's an 8-month isolation window with no physical access to the outside world.
8 months with no way out. If you have a dental emergency, someone on the crew is doing the dentistry.
That's not hypothetical. Winter over doctors are trained in basic dental procedures. There's a famous case from the 1960s where a Soviet doctor at Vostok Station performed an appendectomy on himself. More recently, in 2023, a winter over crew member at the South Pole had to be medically evacuated midwinter for acute pancreatitis, which we'll get to when we talk about alcohol, because that case is directly relevant. The evacuation involved a Twin Otter aircraft flying in temperatures around minus 60 Celsius, which is at the absolute operational limit of the airframe. The fuel gels at those temperatures. The rescue cost the U.S. Antarctic Program roughly $500,000.
$500,000 to extract one person from the South Pole in winter. That's the price tag on isolation.
That's why the screening is so rigorous. Every person you add to the winter over crew is another potential $500,000 evacuation. The stations are not just remote, they're inaccessible in a way that most people can't internalize until they've been through a winter. McMurdo to the South Pole is a 0.1360 kilometers. That's roughly the distance from London to Rome. South Pole to the Russian Vostok station is 1,260 kilometers. South Pole to the Russian station Novolazarevskaya is 2,800 kilometers. These are not distances you cross casually.
Which brings us to the second question. Do scientists at these stations ever actually visit each other?
The short answer is yes, but rarely, and the mechanism is not what people imagine. There is no popover to the Norwegian station for dinner. Culture. Physical interstation visits require aircraft, typically LC-130 ski-equipped Hercules planes, or overland traverses that take 10 to 14 days across the polar plateau. These are major logistical undertakings, not casual trips.
What does collaboration actually look like?
It's mostly virtual. The game changer has been bandwidth. Before 2024, internet at McMurdo and the South Pole relied on a patchwork of geostationary satellites that provided something like 10 megabits per second, shared among everyone on station. That's barely enough for email and basic file transfers. In 2024, Starlink was deployed at both McMurdo and the South Pole station, and bandwidth jumped to around 200 megabits per second. That's a 20-fold increase. Suddenly, scientists could do video calls, transfer large datasets, and collaborate in near real time with colleagues at other stations and at home institutions.
The physical isolation hasn't changed, but the data isolation essentially collapsed overnight.
And that changes the collaboration model. Most interstation collaboration now happens at the planning stage and through shared data platforms. The Antarctic Meteorological Research Center aggregates weather data from stations across the continent. The Polar Earth Observing Network, PolInet, shares seismic and GPS data from dozens of autonomous stations. Scientists at different bases contribute to the same datasets without ever needing to be in the same room, let alone the same station.
There are exceptions. You mentioned station exchanges.
The U.S. Antarctic Program runs a station exchange program where small numbers of scientists can visit other nations' bases for short-term collaborative projects. In 2025, three scientists from Japan's Saiwa Station spent 2 weeks at the South Pole Station collaborating on atmospheric chemistry measurements. They flew in on an LC-130, did their work, and flew back. That's a rare but real thing. There's also the Trans-Antarctic Scientific Traverses. These are coordinated overland expeditions where teams from multiple nations travel together across the continent. The 2025 to 2026 Chinese Russian traverse from Zhongshan Station to Vostok involved 23 scientists from 5 countries. They spent weeks traveling together in a convoy of tracked vehicles, collecting ice cores and atmospheric samples along the route.
A multinational convoy crawling across the ice for weeks. That's the closest thing Antarctica has to a scientific road trip.
It's deeply collaborative in a way that the fly-in, fly-out model isn't. When you're sharing a traverse vehicle for 14 days, you're not just exchanging data, you're building relationships, sharing techniques, troubleshooting equipment together. Some of the most cited Antarctic papers have come out of traverse collaborations, but these traverses are expensive and rare. Maybe one or two major traverses happen per season across the whole continent.
The reality is, collaboration is real and extensive, but it's mediated by satellite links and shared databases. Physical visits happen, but they're special events, not routine. The image of scientists from different nations gathering around a table in the South Pole bar is mostly fiction, except for the bar part, which brings us to the third question.
The alcohol question. And I love that this is the one everyone wants to know. The answer is, yes, alcohol is available at nearly every Antarctic station, and yes, there are bars. McMurdo has the Southern Exposure. The South Pole Station has a bar in the common area. It doesn't have a formal name, but the crew calls it the 90 South Bar. Most stations have some kind of social drinking space.
How much are we talking about?
It's regulated. The U.S. Antarctic Program allows purchase of alcohol at the station store with limits. Typically 2 to 3 drinks per person per day. You can't stockpile. The store tracks purchases. There's a strict no alcohol during work hours policy, and alcohol education is mandatory during winter over training. The message is, drinking is permitted, but it's a privilege, not a right, and the safety implications in a lethal environment are taken very seriously.
2 to 3 drinks a day sounds reasonable until you remember that these people are living in the same building for 8 months with no escape from their coworkers. The bar isn't a place you go to unwind after work. It's the only social venue on the entire continent.
That's where the darker side comes in. Alcohol abuse is a known issue in isolated polar environments. The combination of prolonged darkness, confinement, social friction, and easy access to alcohol creates risk. The U.S. Antarctic Program has dealt with incidents. The most notable recent case was the 2023 medical evacuation from the South Pole, the one I mentioned earlier. A winter over scientist developed acute pancreatitis directly linked to alcohol consumption. The condition became life-threatening, and the station doctor determined evacuation was necessary. The rescue cost approximately $500,000 and triggered a full policy review.
$500,000, because someone couldn't moderate their drinking at the bottom of the world.
The policy change that followed limited personal alcohol stores to the equivalent of 12 standard drinks per week, with stricter tracking. And that's the U.S. program. Different nations have different cultures around this. Russian stations, Vostok, Mirny, have a reputation for more liberal alcohol policies, though exact details are hard to verify because the Russian program is less transparent about its internal operations. The French-Italian Concordia station has one of the strictest policies, no alcohol at all during the first month of winter over, because the station sits at 3,233 meters elevation, and altitude sickness combined with alcohol is a dangerous mix. After acclimatization, limited wine is permitted. It is a French-Italian station, after all.
A French-Italian station that bans wine for the first month. That's got to be the most psychologically grueling aspect of the whole winter-over experience.
The altitude at Concordia is no joke. The effective oxygen level is about half of sea level. You're hypoxic, you're cold, you're isolated, and you can't even have a glass of wine with dinner while your body adjusts. After the first month, they do allow it, but within limits. And there's a fascinating cultural dimension to how different nations approach this. The British Antarctic Survey has historically had a more pub-oriented culture. The Rothera Station Bar is famous, while the German Neumayer Station tends toward a more restrained, almost clinical approach to social drinking. These differences reflect national attitudes toward alcohol, but they're also practical decisions about risk management in a place where a small mistake can kill you.
Let's talk about the beer drop, because I know you've been waiting to tell that story.
The beer drop of 2024. This is one of those stories that sounds like Antarctic folklore but is entirely real. A U.S. Air Force C-17 was conducting a routine airdrop resupply over the South Pole Station. A pallet containing 48 cases of beer, intended for McMurdo, not the South Pole, was accidentally released at 10,000 feet over the pole. The pallet parachuted down and was recovered intact. The South Pole winter over crew suddenly had an unscheduled delivery of nearly 600 beers.
An act of God, but specifically a beer god.
The program decided not to retrieve it or destroy it. They distributed it as a morale boost. It became an instant legend. But it also highlighted the tension at the heart of Antarctic alcohol policy. On one hand, morale is critical. Winter over crews face psychological pressure that most people can't imagine, and social rituals around drinking are a real part of crew cohesion. On the other hand, an unexpected windfall of 600 beers in a station of 42 people is exactly the kind of thing that keeps station commanders up at night.
48 cases for 42 people. That's more than a case per person. Even spread over a winter, that's a lot of beer.
The station manager had to make a judgment call. The official policy limits purchases, but this wasn't a purchase. It fell from the sky. The decision to distribute it was pragmatic. The crew was going to be there for months in total darkness. Taking away the beer would have been worse for morale than letting them have it in moderation.
The alcohol situation is, yes, it's there, it's regulated. The regulations vary by nation, and sometimes the universe intervenes with a parachute delivery. But the serious takeaway is that alcohol policy in Antarctica is a window into how different programs think about isolation, mental health, and risk.
It's a microcosm of a broader challenge. How do you maintain psychological well-being in an environment that is fundamentally hostile to human life? Alcohol is one tool, a problematic one, but a real one. Other tools include carefully designed social spaces, mandatory communal meals, holiday celebrations, and increasingly, telehealth mental health support. The South Pole Station now has regular video sessions with psychologists back in the U.S., made possible by the Starlink bandwidth upgrade.
We've got the numbers. Fewer than 1,000 scientists in Antarctica in winter, effectively zero at the North Pole. We've got the collaboration model, mostly virtual, with rare but real physical exchanges. And we've got the alcohol picture, present, regulated, culturally varied, occasionally delivered by aircraft error.
The numbers are likely to shift in the coming years. The Antarctic Treaty Consultative Meeting just wrapped up in Helsinki this month, May 2026. One of the outcomes was a new framework for station capacity limits, aimed at preventing overcrowding at popular sites like the South Pole. As tourism grows, the 2025 to 2026 season saw 50,000 visitors, up from about 35,000 pre-pandemic. There's increasing pressure to distinguish between scientific and touristic presence. The South Pole doesn't get tourists, but the peninsula stations do, and the overlap is creating friction.
50,000 tourists. That's 10 times the total population of scientists and support staff in summer. Antarctica is becoming a destination.
That raises questions that the treaty system wasn't designed to handle. The Antarctic Treaty of 1959 was written for an era when Antarctica was essentially empty except for scientists and explorers. Now you have cruise ships, tour operators, even a marathon. The treaty parties are grappling with how to cap visitor numbers without undermining the principle of open access. Some stations are already feeling the strain. The South Pole Station was designed for a summer capacity of about 150, and it's been hitting that limit regularly. The new framework would formalize caps based on environmental impact assessments.
The human geography of the poles is shifting in real time, and the numbers we've been throwing around are a snapshot of a system under pressure, which makes the original question, how many scientists are there? More interesting than it first appears. The answer isn't just a census, it's a story about what kind of human presence we're choosing to maintain in these places, and why.
That connects to something I find genuinely exciting. The Artemis program. NASA's plan for a sustained lunar presence is directly studying Antarctic winter over protocols. The South Pole Station is a testbed for off-world habitation. The isolation duration, the crew size, the communication delays, the psychological screening, the alcohol policies, all of it is being mined for lessons about how to run a lunar base. When you look at the 42 people wintering at the South Pole in 2026, you're looking at a dress rehearsal for the first permanent moon cruise.
A dress rehearsal where the bar sometimes gets resupplied by accident. The moon base is going to need a better system for that.
The moon base probably won't have a bar, at least not initially. But the social function that the bar serves, a designated space for informal interaction, a ritual that marks the boundary between work and rest, that will need to be replicated somehow. One of the findings from Antarctic psychology research is that the absence of spatial separation between work and leisure is one of the hardest things about winter over. You work, eat, sleep, and socialize in the same building, often the same few rooms. The bar matters not just because of the alcohol, but because it's a place that is not work.
A room that says, you're off the clock now. Even though you're in the same building, with the same people, in the same eternal darkness. The psychology of that boundary is fascinating.
It's something that remote workers everywhere have discovered in the last few years. The Antarctic experience is an extreme version of a problem that millions of people now face. How do you separate work from life when they happen in the same physical space? The winter over crews have been dealing with this for decades, and their solutions, designated social hours, ritualized transitions, clear spatial zoning, even within a single building, are increasingly relevant far beyond the ice.
The three questions about headcount, collaboration, and alcohol all converge on the same insight. Polar science is a model for extreme remote operations. The challenges that Antarctic crews face, isolation, limited bandwidth until recently, psychological stress, the blurring of work and life, are exactly the challenges that space missions, deep sea research, and increasingly ordinary remote work all have to solve. The poles are the laboratory where we figure out how to be human, in places where humans aren't supposed to be.
The numbers keep it humble. On any given day in July, there are about 42 people at the South Pole, 13 at Concordia, maybe 150 at McMurdo, a few hundred more scattered across the continent. And at the North Pole, nothing but ice and the occasional drifting Russian station with 15 people on it. The entire human presence at the poles, in winter, could fit in a single large lecture hall.
With a bar at the back.
With a bar at the back, yes. And a Starlink terminal sharing data with scientists on the other side of the continent. That's the image I keep coming back to. 42 people at the South Pole in July, in total darkness, running some of the most sensitive scientific instruments ever built. The IceCube Neutrino Observatory, the South Pole Telescope, collaborating with colleagues thousands of kilometers away via satellite internet, and at the end of the day, gathering in a small common room with a drink, looking at the same walls they've looked at for months, and somehow making it work.
That's the thing about extreme environments. They don't just test equipment, they test social structures, policies, cultural assumptions about what people need to stay functional. The alcohol rules at Concordia. No drinking for the first month. That's not just a safety rule. It's a statement about what the French and Italian programs believe about altitude, community, and the role of alcohol in social bonding. The Russian approach says something different. The American approach, strict limits, mandatory education, but a functioning bar, says something else again.
None of these approaches is obviously right or wrong. They're experiments in human systems design, running in parallel across the continent. The fact that we can compare outcomes, which stations have better morale, fewer incidents, higher scientific productivity, is itself valuable. It's comparative policy research conducted under the most controlled conditions imaginable. Total isolation, identical environment, different rules.
I wonder if anyone's actually doing that comparative analysis. A cross-national study of Antarctic station alcohol policies and outcomes.
There have been a few attempts, but data is hard to get because no program wants to be seen as having an alcohol problem. The medical evacuation from the South Pole in 2023 forced the U.S. program to be more transparent, but other nations haven't necessarily followed suit. The Russian program, in particular, is opaque. We know Vostok has a reputation, but we don't have incident data.
Which means the folklore fills the gap. Stories about Russian scientists drinking cognac at minus 80, the beer drop, the Concordia wine policy. The alcohol question generates legends because the reality is simultaneously mundane. Yes, there are bars. Yes, there are limits. And extraordinary because everything that happens at the poles is extraordinary. A bar at the South Pole is not the same as a bar in a city. It's a life support system with a different label.
That brings us to the broader takeaway. The numbers are smaller than most people assume. The collaboration is more extensive than the distances suggest, but it's mediated by technology, not physical presence. The alcohol is there, it's regulated, and the regulations are a surprisingly good lens for understanding how different nations think about isolation and mental health. But the deeper story is that polar science is a testbed. The protocols being developed at the South Pole and Concordia and McMurdo, for communication, for psychological support, for managing a small isolated crew over long durations, are going to be the template for the first lunar bases and eventually Mars missions. When astronauts on the moon are debating their alcohol policy, they'll be drawing on 60 years of Antarctic experience.
Someone will inevitably suggest just airdropping beer from orbit.
I guarantee that idea has already been proposed in a NASA working group, probably as a joke, probably not entirely a joke.
The beer drop of 2035, Lunar Edition. Calling it now.
The logistics would be nightmarish, but morale is morale. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The vivid red auroras occasionally observed at low latitudes are caused by oxygen atoms at altitudes above 200 kilometers emitting light at the 630 nanometer wavelength. A transition so slow it's called forbidden in quantum mechanics, and visible only because the upper atmosphere is so empty that the excited atoms don't collide with anything else before they finally radiate. This same red emission was recorded from Réunion Island during the Great Geomagnetic Storm of October 2003, an unintended consequence of a solar flare arriving at exactly the wrong angle.
Forbidden quantum transitions over Réunion. Here's the open question. As Antarctic tourism hits 50,000 visitors a year, and the treaty parties debate capacity caps, what happens to the science? The stations were built for research, not for managing tourist overflow, but the two are increasingly overlapping on the peninsula. The South Pole is still insulated, no cruise ship is getting there, but the pressure is real. If the Antarctic Treaty System decides to prioritize science over tourism, that's one future. If it opens up, that's another, and neither future has been fully thought through.
The Artemis connection makes this urgent. If the South Pole is a testbed for lunar habitation, then how we manage the human presence in Antarctica, who gets to be there, how many, under what rules, is a preview of how we'll manage the human presence on the moon. The same debates about science versus commerce, about environmental protection versus access, are going to replay themselves on the lunar surface. Antarctica is the dress rehearsal.
The dress rehearsal currently features 42 people at the South Pole in July, in total darkness, collaborating with colleagues on the other side of the continent via Starlink, drinking a beer at the bar, running instruments that detect neutrinos from across the universe. That's the image to leave with. Not a bustling research campus, not a heroic outpost, but a small group of humans in a very cold building on 3 kilometers of ice, doing work that couldn't be done anywhere else, and making it through the winter together.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you have a weird prompt, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com.
Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to us. show my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.